There are a few proposals on the table to build liquefied natural gas receiving hubs and natural gas pipelines that would run from Astoria through the farmlands of western Oregon east through the Mount Hood National Forest to connect with an existing pipeline that runs from Canada to California.
Right through the middle of our property. So one of them starts in, see where those trees are right there, starts in the middle. That's the Palomar pipeline, the Northwest Natural Palomar pipeline. Starts at those trees and goes right through the middle of this field. Goes through that forest, and that 20-acre forest that goes down to the creek down the bottom. That's a native forest. My wife and I have been working for years to replant it and try and keep it a native mixed-use forest. So it's got oak and everything like that. It'll go right through the middle of that forest. And when they come through here, they take out a minimum of 150 feet. And they get a permanent right-of-way of 50 feet that you can't plant, but they take out 150 feet, so they just go through everything and clear-cut everything. So everything you can see for miles, you see a clear-cut 150 foot wide.
One of the first organizing tactics that we took was to get communities along the pipeline to come out against LNG development. And we kind of thought it was a little pie in the sky to go into Yamhill, Gaston, Maupin, all these pretty small towns, not towns you'd think of being friendly to environmentalists or activists that are coming in with a anti-development message. But one after another has passed resolutions against the pipeline, and we have almost every town it goes through has passed a resolution against the pipeline, which is pretty amazing, including Clackamas County, the county itself. So this isn't just one commissioner or one councilman being against it. This is like real organized effort from these small towns to say, you know, we don't agree with this type of development.
Tonight on Circle A Radio, we hear from Amy Harwood, program director for BARC, a local organization dedicated to the preservation of Mount Hood National Forest, and Steve Wick, farmer and activist from Gaston, Oregon, who explain the history of and resistance to the proposed LNG pipelines. Stay tuned.
I am Amy Harwood, and I'm with BARC. I'm a program director, and I have been involved with stopping LNG development in Oregon for about 3 years.
Does BARC stand for anything?
Proudly, we don't have an acronym, but we do stand for lots of things. We originally were named for the barkers at the circus, like the barkers that stand up and cry with persistence to let people know what's happening. And so we think of ourselves as watchdogs that do the same for Mount Hood National Forest. That's where the name came from. Liquefied natural gas has been around for a while. It was, as far as I understand, it was originally created to be able to put gas onto trains to avoid these large pipeline infrastructure that is part of the development that we're fighting against now. I actually am not totally sure of when the rail system stopped being the transporter, but for the Pacific Basin, it's only been recently that there was gas production happening to the capacity that it is now in Russia, Iran, Indonesia, Australia. So the way that they're using this technology now is they're actually putting it on boats, which is different than the trains, obviously, but the same idea that it avoids these huge pipeline infrastructure you can see going across the Pacific Ocean on a boat, as opposed to building pipelines, of course, across the Pacific Ocean, which would never happen. So basically all that LNG is just natural gas that is put into a liquid form in its source country, all of those places across the Pacific, shipped across, and then when it gets to the West Coast, the proposal is to re-gasify it. And the process that it goes through is not only very risky to any communities nearby because it could potentially be very explosive, but it also, one of the things that we've been talking a lot about is that by the time it actually gets to the consumer here in the States from across the Pacific, you're looking at a carbon footprint that's on par with like coal. The amount of gas it takes to liquefy it and then regasify it, the amount of infrastructure it takes, the amount of different industries it's going to take to actually transport gas across the Pacific, doesn't actually make it work out to be this clean energy source that we're being told it is. What's interesting, too, about it coming to Oregon is that there's been five different proposals in California, on the California coast, and all of them have been stopped or indefinitely delayed. There was a proposal that went down to Mexico that they actually did build it, and then about 5-6 years ago saw proposals coming up to Oregon. And I think that they really thought that there would be no one who would notice it, and they could just build them, put in some pipeline infrastructure, hook it up to the Trans-Canada pipeline, the GTN line, which runs the length of eastern Oregon down to California, and just start getting this gas down to California where they know consumers are, but the state of California wasn't allowing it. And interestingly enough, the state of Washington's been pretty clear that they're not going to allow it either. So Oregon has consistently been, for the last 5 years or so, the weak link on the West Coast. And that's why I think there's been such a huge resistance here, is before they really thought that no one was going to notice. And it's really taken people to organize and make sure that these terminals don't get built and the pipelines don't get built. The state government here does not have those stoppers that California and Washington have had to be able to say, you know, don't even try it.
So is that some kind of department in the California or Washington government that our government just doesn't have, or is it just people in the positions?
Different. There was different reasons for it. In California, it really ultimately came down to a safety issue and a terrorism threat. There also was some like pretty serious organizing that was happening around some of these different proposals. So like down in Malibu, you saw this becoming a pretty sexy, friendly campaign for lots of stars to get on. And so it was, you know, it was a really big deal there. And up in Humboldt, I think you saw, you know, a lot of activist communities that had been organized for a long time anyway, using those networks to stop it. So, you know, I don't want to just say it was only those things, but that was a big driver for stopping a lot of them. And then up in Washington, I mean, they haven't actually had a proposal that has been put through any serious process yet. But what they have is the Department of Natural Resources. And that state agency in Washington is actually a pretty powerful state agency. They have some really amazing people working for them. And they've always been one of the agencies that's really lifted Washington up in terms of its environmental laws. And the state of Oregon just doesn't have that kind of agency or those kinds of advocates in our state government.
You're listening to Amy Harwood on Circle A Radio.
There are three terminals proposed for Oregon. Two are on the Columbia River, pretty close to the mouth. One is on the mouth, and then one is further upriver. And there's another one down in Coos Bay in southern Oregon. And all three of them have pipeline infrastructure that's associated with them. The one down in Coos Bay has a pipeline called the Pacific Connector. It has a sort of similar story to it, that it goes through farmland, goes through national forests, and ultimately reaches this GTN line, the Trans-Canada pipeline that goes down to California. The terminals up here in northern Oregon, northwestern Oregon, are on the Columbia, and the pipelines would leave from front door of the terminals and head down towards the Willamette Valley and eventually would meet up in about the Malala area, so south of Portland. Then they head east. They go through Clackamas County and then go up through Mount Hood National Forest. And then they cross into eastern Oregon through Maupin. They actually have one proposal to put it through downtown Maupin, through the main street. And then it crosses the Deschutes and heads over and meets up with this GTN line several hundred miles north of where the Pacific Connector line would connect down in southern Oregon, if that makes sense. So it's about 600 miles of pipeline infrastructure that they're proposing. And in May of 2010, of this year, we got news that Bradwood Landing, which is one of the terminals on the Columbia, has gone bankrupt. So, you know, with all the organizing and all the work that was put into making sure that they were held accountable to the permits that they had to go through, and I'm sure more money than we'll ever know going into PR and trying to get Astoria and communities nearby on board, they basically were bled dry as far as we can tell. I mean, they are totally bankrupt now. That still leaves one of the terminals up on the Columbia, which is Oregon LNG. And Oregon LNG's pipeline meets up with the Palomar pipeline. Originally, the Palomar pipeline was the pipeline that would connect Bradwood to this GTN line 217 miles later. It gets a little confusing because there are so many different parts to it, but the part that I've been working on for 3 years is this section of the Palomar pipeline that crosses Mount Hood National Forest. When I first got involved with the campaign, I was so inspired by all the people who were impacted by these pipelines and weren't just sitting down and giving up. I mean, they were getting organized and showing up on a regular basis and meeting and getting really smart on energy policy.
That was Amy Harwood, Program Director for BARC.
This is Steve Wick, farmer and activist from Gaston, Oregon.
So our property, we've got 60 acres. And we're in the very northern tip of Yamhill County. We can almost throw rocks into Washington County. And the LNG pipelines go from Forest Grove. They actually come over the coastal range. And you can see the coastal range here. Over the coastal range. And then they head south through the Yamhill Valley here. And then they go down and cross the river down near Dayton. And then they head east. And so our property has plans for two of them. And actually the two of them run right through the middle of our property. So one of them starts in, see where those trees are right there, starts in the middle. That's the Palomar pipeline, the Northwest Natural Palomar pipeline. Starts at those trees and goes right through the middle of this field. Goes through that forest, and that 20-acre forest that goes down to the creek down the bottom. That's a native forest. My wife and I have been working for years to replant it and try and keep it a native mixed-use forest. Whereas a lot of people around here, you know, you can see the fir. That's what the commercial guys use, is fir. We try to keep it a mixed-use forest, so it's got oak and everything like that. It'll go right through the middle of that forest. And when they come through here, they take out a minimum of 150 feet. And they get a permanent right-of-way of 50 feet that you can't plant, but they take out 150 feet. So they just go through everything and clear-cut everything. So everything you can see for miles, you'd see a clear-cut 150 foot wide. So that was the Palomar pipeline I'm talking about that runs right through the middle of the property. Oregon LNG, the other one that comes from Warrenton, is underneath those power lines down there. That's my property too. And then it goes right along the edge of my neighbor's hazelnut orchard there, through his plums and through his cherry orchard. And if you look down the corner down there, that's my neighbor's vineyard down there. And it goes through the edge of my property and through the edge of his vineyard. So just doesn't take out my edge of my property. It takes out all these trees and vineyards on my neighbors. So you have two pipelines that were planned here, two LNG pipelines that parallel each other by approximately 200 yards or something like that. You know, and you know, the bad thing is with the Palomar plant in Bradwood was quote unquote shut down. The Palomar pipelines are not shut down. And Northwest Natural, or I should say, the Palomar people, because Palomar is half Northwest Natural, half TransCanada, sent us a little letter in the mail. Oh, don't worry about it. You can do whatever you want, but we might come back in a year, or we might come back in 2 years. And so instead of shutting down this pipeline and letting us have our property back so we can do what we want, we've got to sit in limbo for a year or a couple years or something like that. Until what are they going to do? Remarket the whole thing? And that's what we're afraid they're going to do, because when Bradwood went broke, part of the paperwork said that $17 million that they owed Northwest Natural, they were going to give Northwest Natural all their permits for Bradwood and stuff like that.
How much of your land are they going to have to take over to build the roads to actually put the pipeline in?
You know, it was real interesting for Oregon LNG. We got to see the construction diagrams, and instead of just 150 feet for where the pipeline goes, there's also construction right-of-ways. Luckily, I don't have any big ones. There are some where it turns down here. They take an additional 75 and 50 feet for staging, and maybe bigger for staging pipe. Some people have a lot more than that. One of the people over there found out that they're going to have a pumping station on their property. That meant that they had to bring in, they never told them. In fact, they were out on their property with them. We were on a tour, and they didn't tell them. They found out later when they looked at a map that they had left. They were planning on putting in a pumping station, and that takes, well, I shouldn't say a pumping station, a station where they put electrodes in that minimize the corrosion of the pipelines. So these pipelines are made out of steel, and they corrode in the ground, and they probably put, they're called anode stations, and they put them in to try and eliminate the corrosion. Now, it doesn't always work, because Williams, the company that has all the pipelines throughout Oregon that supply us with natural gas, one of their pipelines in, I believe it was in the Midwest, may have been Kentucky, I don't remember, about a year ago exploded. And the reason it exploded is because they weren't taking care of the corrosion on the pipes. And they knew they weren't. And the pipeline literally blew up and it exploded. So, you know, we're going, gosh, these guys don't have a very good track record of maintaining the pipelines. When we first found out about this, we got a notice in the mail. That was it. It didn't, no map, nothing telling us any, how big the pipeline was. It didn't say anything. We'd have to keep begging every time. Oh, do you have a map where it's going to go? Oh, I guess we can send that to you. You know, nothing that it was a 36-inch pipeline. Nothing telling you that it had 1,500 PSI pressure in it, which is ungodly amount of pressure. The pressure in the tires in your car is only like 60 pounds or something like that. 1,500 PSI pressure. Nothing telling us that the shutoffs on the pipelines are 10 to 20 miles apart. So if something happens to the pipeline, it gets a leak or breaks or something like that, it leaks and leaks and leaks until it finds an explosion source, catches on fire, and they can't put it, you can't put them out. It has to burn. They have to burn all that gas out of the pipeline. So that's another concern we had. Back in the 40s, we had the Tillamook burn. It burnt, I don't know how many times, 4 or 5 times, something like that, okay? If one of those pipelines is in that Tillamook burn and the ground shifts just like it did, so up there in Collett County, it's the same geological formations up there that we have down here. Ground shifts, the pipeline breaks and leaks, leaks and leaks and leaks and leaks. They don't know it. And then it finds the ignition source, it goes off, Tillamook burn again. So, you know, we're going. You know, it would be okay, maybe, if this country needed the gas. But the problem is, we don't need this imported fossil fuel. And right now, if they say, well, you gotta have natural gas, we gotta use it as a bridge to the future. Well, they're already building a natural gas pipeline from Wyoming. It's already almost started, it's got a couple. They're stacking the pipe for it. It's a 42-inch pipeline that's coming from Wyoming down into southern Oregon, then it goes into the main pipeline that feeds Washington and Oregon and California. And when the gas companies kept telling us, well, only one LNG pipeline is really needed. Well, we don't need any now if we got natural gas coming from Wyoming and it's already being built. Mm-hmm. Yeah, we can get our own natural gas in the United States. It's going to be cheaper, but it needs to be looked at. But there's really no reason for LNG, for importing gas from third world countries into the United States when we've got plenty of our own, and there's a wonderful opportunity for us also to use renewables, and we're not doing that. You know, it's just, I mean, I was just reading an article in the paper the other day. Portugal, since 2000, they're getting a huge percent of their energy off of renewables. And it's something that we could do, but.
And when you say renewables, what are you talking about?
So renewables, what I'm talking about is wind, solar, and then there's some of these other different types of solar. There's some of the waves type systems that they're coming online and stuff like that. So that's what I'm talking about in a renewable. It's one that where we're not using, taking fossil fuel out of the ground or some other, taking it out of sand, taking it out of shale, or taking it out of oil or gas. So it's a renewable resource that we don't have to worry about creating carbon and causing problems for our country.
Do you want to talk a little bit about the organizing that's been happening around the pipeline down here? Like, how did that start? And
well, the way it started is the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission finally came in and had meetings to discuss this with us. But they weren't two-way meetings. They just told us a bunch of stuff. They didn't answer any questions. And it was, you know, there was no information. We still couldn't get information about the pipelines. I mean, At that point, somebody said a few things about them. We didn't know what the pressure was or how big they were or how deep they were going to plant them. Nothing like that was ever told to us. So anyhow, we went to some of those meetings, and some people start taking other people's phone numbers and addresses and stuff like that. And when I first found out about this, I started reading the papers, and I go, oh, there's going to be a meeting in Astoria about an LNG plant they're going to go put in down there. And I said, I'm going down to Astoria. I told my wife, I'm going down for the day and find out. And I went to this meeting, and I sat next to somebody. Well, I sat next to a gal from Washington. They'd been fighting the pipeline for a lot longer than we had. We just found out about it. They knew about their pipeline for 2 or 3 years. And I sat next to her, and then I heard a couple people speak, and one of them was Dan Sarah's from Riverkeepers. So I went up and introduced myself to him later on, and then the next thing I know, when we started to organize here, all the local people started to organize. Riverkeepers helped us organize. And so we formed chapters called Oregon Citizens Against the Pipeline. So I'm a member of the one in Forest Grove because I'm next to Washington County, and I'm a member of the one down here in Yamhill County because I'm part of Yamhill County. So that's it's just a loose coalition of people, Oregon Citizens Against the Pipeline. So we've got them all along the pipeline, you know. We keep everybody informed, send emails, chain emails and stuff like that. And that's how we organize.
Are there other folks who actually support the pipeline in your area?
Yes, there are some people that support the pipeline in the area. I mean, we've gone to some political meetings and stuff like that, and there's been some people there. And, you know, we just try to inform them. You know, it's kind of nice sometimes if you go to a meeting or something and you find out somebody that's supporting it, and you ask them why, and we can give them 10,000 reasons why not.
Where does that seem to be coming from, the folks who do think it's a good idea?
Well, there's people that actually are, like I used to be, not informed. So they think it's another source of energy and that America's running out of energy. So they think, oh, we should have it because we're running out of energy. It's not true. We're not running out of energy. We've got all this natural gas. We have the opportunity for a lot of renewables and stuff like that. So these people they're just not up on things. One of our friends in the OCAP group's got a neighbor that thinks that he's going to get rich when they put the pipeline through his property. And I was also talking to an old friend of mine that has two of the pipelines going through his property. He says, well, when they get done putting those pipelines through, if they do, he says, I'm selling my property. And he says, I'm going to use some of the money I get from them. And I go, do you know how much money you're going to get from them? And he goes, no. And I says, well, usually what they'll pay you is 10% of the value of the 50-foot easement, permanent easement. They'll give you a one-time payment, 10% of the value of that 50-foot piece of property through your, and give you a one-time payment, and that's supposed to last for you or whoever else buys your property. I'll give you an example of that. Can you see that tower down there? That's a BPA, Bonneville Power Administration, power line right away. And you can see the towers go through there, okay? Now that, whoever owned my property back in 1947 sold that easement to BPA for $250. Now that was a lot of money back in 1947, so they got that. But now I can't use that easement, and I could have hazelnuts underneath it, I could do whatever I wanted underneath it, and so I'm losing money now. But they got a one-time payment that they thought was absolutely wonderful, but the owners in the future, we don't get reimbursed for our loss of that property.
That was Steve Wick, farmer and activist from Gaston, Oregon. This is Amy Harwood.
We have had the potential with Mount Hood National Forest to bring this issue to a larger group of people. So we sort of think of it as growing the impacted landowners by bringing Mount Hood National Forest into it, since we all own Mount Hood National Forest. The other thing is that BARC, whenever we take on a new project, the first thing we do is get on the ground. We are, for the most part, made up of a lot of self-taught naturalists and experts. So one of the things that we do is by getting on the ground, we immediately gain credibility because oftentimes these agencies haven't actually been on the ground. And by being some of the first people to actually go out and see what's threatened, we immediately gain a foothold in the conversation. So in the summer of 2008, I led some volunteers to hike the 47-mile section that goes across Mount Hood. I can quickly tell you that it is some of the most beautiful sections of Mount Hood National Forest. I mean, it's just beautiful. It goes through old-growth forests. It crosses the Clackamas at this extremely scenic bend in the river. It goes up to Timothy Lake and crosses the Pacific Crest Trail and then heads down into eastern Oregon, down the slopes, right above Warm Springs, the boundary of Warm Springs, where 26 goes into Warm Springs. And it was an amazing experience to actually walk this thing and go at that pace and really get to know some of the areas that it was threatening. And I found that in organizing and going up in front of some of these federal agencies, we're getting cornered by energy executives, and you know, they can be pretty threatening. They're pretty empowered people themselves. And when I get up and tell them that I've actually walked this thing, well, first, they usually don't believe me. And then when I tell them what I saw, they can't say anything. There's nothing they can say in argument, which I think has been a really interesting thing to see how that plays out organizing wise. So the pipeline itself, it would be 36 inches wide. The corridor that they're proposing is at a minimum 50 feet. And that's the permanent clear-cut corridor that they're proposing. They would have a buffer on either side of about 50 to another 100 feet that they would be in Mount Hood clear-cutting, and down in the farms and lowlands they would be clearing in order to construct it, but eventually letting it grow back. And the permanent right-of-way would be 50 feet. The Palomar pipeline goes about 217 miles. And one of the things that we've been asking a lot of questions about is how much infrastructure is actually needed to maintain a pipeline that's that long. So you're looking at trucks and maintenance vehicles using old county roads, old forest roads, requiring them to stay open, maybe when they don't necessarily need to be, and essentially putting some pretty intense pressure on some of these small communities to be making sure that those pipelines aren't a major security risk. I know that the town of Malala came out against this project specifically because they were aware of the fact that they have more seismic activity in their town than almost anywhere in northwestern Oregon. Just that simple fact alone was convincing to them that they don't have the emergency services to deal with this large of a pipeline going through their community. And it's interesting, one of the first organizing tactics that we took was to get communities along the pipeline to come out against LNG development. And we kind of thought it was a little pie in the sky to go into Yamhill, Gaston, Maupin, all these pretty small towns, not towns you'd think of being friendly to environmentalists or activists that are coming in with a anti-development message. But one after another has passed resolutions against the pipeline. And we have almost every town it goes through has passed a resolution against the pipeline, which is pretty amazing, including Clackamas County, the county itself. So this isn't just one commissioner or one councilman being against it. This is like real organized effort from these small towns to say, you know, we don't agree with this type of development. There hasn't been any upgrade of the transmission system in 50 years. I mean, Bonneville Power Administration has basically been overseeing our cheap hydroelectric power for a long time, and we've had this one gas pipeline that's come into the Portland metro area for years and years, and there just hasn't been, these proposals have not come around for a long time. It's really hard to imagine what it's actually going to look like to have these fresh cuts and have this fresh, I mean, this is large scale development that's happening in places that we're not used to seeing that kind of development. It's kind of like, for people who have been here for 10 years watching the development of wind energy in eastern Oregon, it's a startling thing to drive out there and think you know what that landscape looks like and have it so drastically altered, for better or for worse. For BARC, one of the reasons why we got really involved and we feel like investing our limited resources that we have and our staff time into working on particularly this project is because we see this is the beginning of what public lands are going to be all about. So for many years in this area, activists have been fighting off companies from logging public lands. That has been this, you know, successful subsidy for the timber industry. I think that the reality is that public lands is now the hot subsidy for renewable energy. You've got biomass companies interested in linking up with national forests. 9,000 acres of Mount Hood National Forest just opened up to geothermal. Obviously, the wind energy, the wind development that's happening in eastern Oregon requires massive amounts of transmission lines. So you have PGE proposing a new transmission corridor through the Willamette National Forest that would be a whole other transmission corridor. It's not just the power lines you think of around town. We're talking large-scale towers that you would see for a long distance. As far as BARC is concerned, we really want to get our activists and our volunteers thinking about this stuff and thinking critically and smart about it, because there's a lot of gray area out there. I mean, one way or another, renewable energy is going to happen, and it's hopefully going to be more localized. It's hopefully going to be partnered with conservation standards and all sorts of new technology that ensures we don't need to have this massive development. But it is a shift. And right now, our transmission grid does not meet up with where we source that type of renewable energy. We don't have transmission lines that lead to places where wind power is ideal. And we don't have transmission lines that lead to future biomass plants. I mean, they just don't match up. So with renewable energy comes a whole new transmission grid. And it is very easy for BARC to come out against the Palomar pipeline because it's associated with foreign fossil fuel. But we recognize that this is the no is the easy part. It's the yes that's going to get really difficult. And we're just hoping that we are training and inspiring activists to actually start thinking critically about this issue and get ready, because it's going to be our biggest challenge, I think, in terms of public lands advocates. But if you're going to build something across Mount Hood or across Willamette or across Giver Pinto National Forest, at some point you have to go to the public and say, you know, can we build this thing? I do have this sort of calming feeling when I think about all the ills in the world, that at least we live here and have this one buffer of land that we still do maintain some control over. And I don't know, I think with the energy development, it's going to become all the more clear, like, how valuable that really is.
That was Amy Harwood.
You're listening to an interview with Amy Harwood, Program Director for BARC, here on Circle A Radio, on your community radio station, KBOO Portland. Next up, we hear from Steve Wick, a local farmer and activist.
If the gas companies, if the LNG companies, came through here and said, we'll buy up every piece of property that we're going to go through, we'll buy your complete property and we'll give you a market price, or we'll give you a fair market price for your entire piece of property, people go, oh, well, okay, you'll buy our whole property, you'll buy my 60 acres for a good market price, not this reduced value we got right now, I'll consider doing that. They don't do that. They have a right of eminent domain, and that was given to them by the 2005 Energy Act, even though they are private companies and they're only doing this for private gains. They still were granted the right to take our property through eminent domain, and we can't stop them. There's nothing we can do. We can negotiate with them on price, but we can't stop them. And so that's another problem. Somebody's taking your property, how would you like?
What kind of support does, you know, your loose coalition desire from folks who are not directly affected by the pipeline?
Well, one of the things, we started a campaign called Hey Northwest Natural. We like people to tell Northwest Natural there's no reason for them to build another pipeline, you know, to clear cut Mount Hood, to go through Mount Hood Wilderness to put a pipeline in. There's really no reason to do it. And that's a Northwest Natural pipeline. And the more people that understand that Northwest Natural isn't trying to help Oregon out, They're not here to help Oregon out. They're here to rape and pillage Oregon. That's what the LNG pipeline's doing, and they're half owner of the darn thing. So we'd like people to understand that and tell Northwest Natural, don't you dare build a pipeline across the Mount Hood Wilderness or through this whole Willamette Valley and rape and pillage the Willamette Valley and stuff like that. So that's one of the things we want people to understand, people in Portland, that, you know, supporting Northwest Natural, you need to be careful and watch them. And the other thing that, you know, we like our help, their help, in talking to our legislators to make sure our legislators send a strong message that LNG is not needed. But we need strong statements from all of our leaders that it's not needed, especially down in Salem. And we've had some problems with some people that are saying, oh, it's jobs. So there'll be jobs building the pipeline, so we need it. You know, our Speaker of the House, our Democratic Speaker of the House, is supposed to be there to support us and help put in renewable energy. He sent a letter to the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission saying, oh, we want these LNG pipelines. I mean, what's that all about? We don't need it. That we literally do not need it.
I mean, I'm glad you brought up the jobs argument, because that's what we see in every community where they try to build something that's destructive to the community, and they say, well, it's going to provide jobs, but there's very few jobs it really does provide even.
Actually, that's true. For an LNG plant on the coast, I think it was like 60 jobs. For the pipeline, they bring crews in from out of state, Texas and stuff, that are specialists and know how to build the pipelines. They're not going to employ people from Oregon, because it's a specialized skill. And so there's limited jobs for a limited amount of people, for a limited time.
Well, I guess we should ask if there's anything else that you want to talk about that we haven't asked you about today.
Well, when I talk about this, I talk about how it affects me. And so I'm a NIMBY, not in my backyard. That's what I am. But what we have to understand is it's not just the farmers and the stuff where the pipelines are going. It's going to affect everybody. If they actually did bring in LNG, it's more costly. They would bring it in, and the first thing that would do, it was raise the rates for everybody that had natural gas. Because, first of all, they got to pay for all of it. And by law, all the costs for the energy have to be passed on to the people that are using it. So there's tankers that it would have to bring it in. They cost over $1 billion each tanker. And so they would have to have new tankers to bring it in. The plants, I don't know how much to build it. All those costs for that energy infrastructure would have to be passed on to the citizens of Oregon. And when they did that, then they try to raise the price of gas in the United States to match what the price of this imported junk is. And our costs for natural gas would go up. Now, we don't just use natural gas for heating our houses or for making electricity. As a farmer, natural gas is used to make some of our fertilizers. And so it would affect everything. So that's another thing to think about, is what would happen to people if they did bring in LNG. It literally would raise the cost for everything.
That was Steve Wick.
This is Amy Harwood, Program Director for BARC.
One of the places that has been, for me, one of the more profound experiences to get to know because of the Palomar Pipeline is Fish Creek. And everybody who's been organizing with me and spending time on this campaign is probably sick of hearing about Fish Creek. But I talk about Fish Creek a lot because the story of Fish Creek holds everything about why BARC and BARC supporters are so uncompromised about stopping the Palomar Pipeline. In the late 90s, there was this huge flooding event that brought down all the roads that had been built in the Fish Creek watershed. And the Fish Creek watershed is this tributary of the Clackamas River. And there was a bunch of emergency funding that was sent to the Forest Service. And BARC had a say, and we got involved and had a say in what that emergency funding went towards. And the Forest Service did the right thing. And they opted to, rather than rebuild all those roads, which were basically falling off of the slopes into Fish Creek and having huge impacts on the stream and on the fish that were in that stream, they actually ripped out over 125 miles of roads. essentially making a roadless area. And they didn't just take the asphalt out. They actually ripped up the roads. They took out the culverts and they put millions of dollars into basically restoring this watershed. And so for 10 years, we've been going out to that area and just watching it kind of recover. And it's amazing. Every time there's major flooding or large storms, something new happens out there. And all the feeder creeks into Fish Creek have been realigning themselves and kind of cutting into the slope of the, you know, where the road had been. And it's an amazing thing to be able to watch that happen. There was a lot of fish biologists that got really excited about the potential of salmon coming back up Fish Creek. And so they started investing more money and they were building log jams out there and trying to recreate some habitat just to get it going. And it's been incredible. And so when I started looking at the maps, I realized that this was 2 years ago. I realized that Fish Creek was part of the Palomar Pipeline proposal. The pipeline is proposed to go 3 miles upriver from where Fish Creek meets the Clackamas. And in order for them to construct that pipeline, they'd have to rebuild all those roads. That simple fact is exactly why this project is so wrong. We have actually made some gains in restoration. Restoration can often be a farce and it doesn't work and it's a waste of money. But when it does work and when it is a good investment, we should be defending those places just as hard as we defend those native forests and those places that didn't get touched, because it means something to people that that much work went into trying to fix what went wrong. One of the things we found with the Forest Service is that by highlighting this area and showing that they're doing something good, they've actually been really helpful to us and not fallen back on the animosity that has existed between environmental activists in this area and the Forest Service. And where sometimes we can't talk about most things, this is one of those issues. I actually have had really good relationship with the Forest Service, and they see the potential destruction as being a threat to some of the good stuff that they've been doing and the relationships that maybe we do have in the future. So that's been really interesting to me, and I am pretty much psyched to bring anybody up there who wants to go, because it's remarkable and it's totally beautiful. I originally got involved in the coalition because I went to the Climate Convergence, which was a big event on the river 3 years ago. I had been asked to come and do a place-based organizing training for people. At BARC, we usually think of our work as much more place-based than issue-based. So I was going out just to talk to them about what that means to organize around a place and what are the benefits. And what was so amazing is that they were already so tapped into their place. They knew that that's what they were organizing around, and that it wasn't about fighting the energy policies that have resulted in LNG coming to the Columbia. It's just about the Columbia River. That was really powerful to me, and I saw the way that they were using that in this really moving way. And so I actually hopped in my truck and drove home immediately after the workshop and was just like, I'm going to quit my job. And I emailed the board as soon as I got the board of BARC, as soon as I got back. And I was like, I can't work for BARC. I need to go out to Astoria. This is the issue. I need to be out there. The next day I kind of settled down and actually like, all right, how am I going to do this? And then I looked at the map and I was like, wait a minute, this thing really does go through Mount Hood National Forest. Like, the pipeline is just as connected to LNG development as the terminal itself. Like, we should be able to connect these things. And so I sort of settled down and sent another email out and said, I won't leave if you take this on as a major campaign tomorrow. And so they did, which was great. And it wasn't very hard to convince them, because I think they saw the potential of organizing and taking Mount Hood and, like I was saying, like using Mount Hood as a way to get more and more people involved in this issue. So from there, we linked up with Columbia Riverkeeper and with the Oregon chapter of the Sierra Club. And the three organizations have sort of become the mainstays as far as financial resources and staff resources, legal resources for the impacted landowners that live along the pipeline and in Astoria. Organizing the impacted landowners actually was not very difficult because by the time we actually were getting on the ground, they were all starting to get eminent domain notices, and they were starting to organize themselves in their own communities. There was a group called Oregon Citizens Against the Pipeline that was formed, and they fairly naturally started meeting along the pipeline monthly in the community so that people weren't driving hours and hours. They just had these meetings, one in Forest Grove, one in Woodburn, one in Malala, and one in Yamhill happens once a month. And so Oregon Citizens Against the Pipeline, or OCAP, meetings still happen once a month 3 years later. And we have organizers that go out and just bring updates to them. And I've led a couple of trainings at the meetings. But it's really remarkable. I mean, there are some really tight communities out there, but we definitely have seen people who I don't think normally get along very well working together, knowing that that's the only way they're going to be able to stop this thing from going through their land. I actually recently was out leading a training on how to do, we took what BARC does with ground truthing and reapplied it to being able to survey and inventory the impacts to each of the landowners. So whereas I'm usually going out and counting how many, you know, old growth trees there are in an area that's going to be cut, I was trying to come up with similar things that farmers could look at or vintners could look at. And it was really interesting because they really took to it and they realized that understanding their own land better and deeper was going to help them to advocate for it better. So we talked about how to take a photograph well that actually showed what they were trying to look for, how to take notes in an organized way that they would later be able to use in hearings and in testimony, and how to map their land in a way that wasn't so much the way that they probably are mapping it for, you know, farming systems, but actually to map it so that one of the agencies would understand what they were talking about. And it was really rewarding because I think at first I thought, well, they already know their land. They're not going to want to go through this. But they're all so determined and so supportive of each other that as soon as one person said, you know, actually, I've never actually taken pictures of where this thing goes through my land. I probably should do it. Somebody else was saying, well, I could help with that. I could come out and, you know, you could stand and then you will get sizes and we'll be able to see the relative size of the things that you're talking about. So it was really interesting seeing how supportive they are. And it gets even more interesting when I go lobby with loggers. I mean, there's a lot of the pipeline that goes through forest lands that are private timberlands, and those guys are trying their best to come up with more sustainable practices and do their forestry in a way that won't be a legacy of clear cutting and naked slopes. So when we go and sit in Senator Merkley's office and we're saying the same thing, it gets them to pay attention. They kind of can't believe it's happening. And sometimes I can't even really believe it's happening, but it's been a really powerful experience. And I've learned a lot. You know, you always learn a lot from sitting on the same side of the table with somebody you never thought you would.
You're listening to Amy Harwood here on Circle A Radio.
The biggest thing I think that we have not clearly communicated to people is none of these projects are truly dead. And by that I mean they all still have active applications or permits with the Federal Energy Regulatory Commission. So even though Bradwood has no money, they have something that's very, very valuable, which is an application or a permit into the FERC that they could sell to another company who would later resurrect the project. And that's happened already a couple times. That's happened with Oregon LNG a couple of years ago. And that could definitely happen again. The victory that recently happened with the Palomar pipeline, we started making a list of all the ways that Palomar seemed like it couldn't possibly be to us. They have still not been able to get a biological opinion that says this pipeline would not impact threatened species. They still have not even put out an environmental impact statement. They don't have any gas to put in their pipeline. I mean, we basically made a list of all the ways that it just doesn't seem possible that this thing's actually going to get built. Because, of course, an energy company's not going to just disappear, right? I mean, they're going to put in a couple million dollars to just gracefully kind of fizzle out over enough years that nobody even notices that we won. we started making this list just like, hey, maybe we should check in and see if it seems like we're winning. And I called the Forest Service around that time that I was making this list, kind of just thinking like maybe we're actually kind of winning here. And I called the Forest Service and I said, hey, I just want to check in on some of those surveys. What's going on? And the Forest Service told me, well, actually, we've put those surveys on hold. We're not working on this anymore. We don't have any of our specialists working on this project anymore. And that really resonated with me. So I started asking some more questions to Palomar. And within a couple of days, they posted this very cryptic letter to the FERC, basically saying, we're on hold, but we're not done. We're coming back with more, but we're taking... the language is ridiculously vague, but essentially saying we're going to have a very different project soon. And we still don't know what that means, but it felt important to make sure we told people, you know, this project is indefinitely on hold. And that's a victory. Because 3 years ago, when I first got involved with this, their construction schedule said they would be clearing a 47-mile clear cut across Mount Hood National Forest this summer. And that's not happened. That's not even close to happening. So that's worth something. And that's why we went to the press and we explained what's going on, that this project is on hold, and gave context to the fact that this thing was supposed to be getting built this year and it's not even close. And we have had so much interest around this campaign that the news definitely saw merit in running that, and they reported on it in this very positive light, which was exciting. And a lot of people were like, oh, it's over, but it's not. I mean, the project is still going forward as far as we know. And then there's also still Oregon LNG. So there's that terminal on the Columbia. There's the second terminal. It also has not gone away. Really importantly to remember, Southern Oregon is definitely still on the table. In fact, I would say that we will probably be putting a lot more resources into trying to stop Southern Oregon, because without access to the population center of Portland and the media center, and also not having the representation in Salem that we do here, I think Southern Oregon has been seen by a lot of legislators and community leaders, the sacrifice. And for those of us who have been working on LNG, we've never seen it that way. We've always seen LNG as all needing to go, and none of it is acceptable here. And I think that we've been recently realizing we need to put some more energy into Southern Oregon and really making sure that those victories start happening down there as well. That would be sort of our next steps right now, is putting focus into stopping Southern Oregon and also making sure that we can really finish up the job here. The other thing, like I was saying, is this isn't over. I think energy corridors are going to become a major issue in this area. We only have one pipeline that comes into the Portland metro area, and we have a lot of wind energy that's also interested in getting on the grid. There's a lot of talk about how we'll need gas-fired plants to back up wind energy development as it's getting more reliable. And this is kind of off the subject, but the thing that I have been really thinking a lot about is this idea of reliability. For a long time, energy companies have just been obsessed with the idea that if they are going to create a system, it has to be the most reliable. It has to be the best. There has to be no hiccups, no days where things go brown, or we lose heat for an hour or something. I mean, there's this real driving obsession with reliability. What it is creating is this justification for making a redundant system. We need to start questioning that. And we need to start questioning whether we actually can afford that type of redundancy anymore. Because I don't think we can afford to have an entire backup corridor just because we might lose gas for one day in the middle of the winter, which is not to say I want people getting cold in the middle of winter, but I think that there are other options to making sure that we still have what we need. I know I have to start asking questions as soon as I see the word reliability in any energy proposal.
Amy Hartwood.
There's one thing I tell everybody, go see it. Go see this proposal for yourself. The Palomar Pipeline crosses the Clackamas River about 2.5 miles south of the Ripple Brook Ranger Station, which most people know. It's the place you pass to pee on the way to Bagby Hot Springs. But there's a little stake with an orange flag on the side of the road that says Palomar on it. Stop and get out of your car and go walk down to the Clackamas River. You can follow the little stakes with the little orange flags on them all the way down to the river and go see where they're proposing to put this thing. The minute you get that image in your head, you'll want to help. You want to get involved. It's so beautiful. It is so impactful to see that stretch of river. There's a dozen other glorious places along the route, but they're harder to get to. And that one spot will really give the flavor of what they're asking us to sacrifice. And then if you're really feeling it when you get back, you can go to bark-out.org. And we have a lot of ways of people get involved on our website. There's also another website that's going up called weagreenolng.org. And that website is going to be more of a statewide resource. So if people are listening to this and they're down in Southern Oregon or closer to Southern Oregon, or they're on the other side of Mount Hood and interested in getting involved, there'll be ways to get involved wherever you are in the state. I really feel like if people get out there and then start talking about this, I mean, one of the things that we found was really successful with the recent, we had a rally at the Northwest Natural shareholders meeting. Northwest Natural is one of the principal investors in the Palomar Pipeline. And we have annually held a rally at their shareholders meeting. And this past year was much larger rally than we'd had in the past. And that really was a result of people talking about this issue. And I think despite the fact that it's starting to resonate on the mainstream, there's still a lot of people who don't even know what LNG stands for or what it is. They may have seen a button, they may have seen a sign, but they don't really know what it is. And I think we still haven't quite gotten over that hump where everyone knows what it is. I think going up against an energy industry is pretty scary and intimidating, especially when we live in a town that more or less has a monopoly running our gas supply. Everybody who has gas in their house gets it from Northwest Natural, and you never really kind of want to be the person who's going home after the rally and turning on your heat and realizing, you know, you're still supporting the company that you're rallying against. But that's the reality, and I think we need to be braver than that and not feel like we can't protest.
Thank you for listening to Circle A Radio. For more information on BARC, visit their website at www.bark-out.org. To learn more about Oregon Citizens Against Pipelines and ways to get involved, visit www.usafirst.info.
Circle A Radio is a feminist, anti-authoritarian public affairs program produced at KBOO Community Radio in Portland, Oregon. Contact us by email at circlearadio@gmail.com or through our website at www.kboo.fm/circlearadio. Thanks for listening.